Thank you, Simone. It is a triple honor to be here. The first is because of the opportunity to be having a conversation in a tradition of higher learning that my country has always emulated. The second is the opportunity to be here at this institute, whose reputation in my part of the world long precedes it. And the third is because my co-authors, Cynthia Miller Idris from American University and Setaneh Shami from the Arab Council for Social Sciences in Beirut, and a colleague, Justin Powell from the University of Luxembourg, are here. And we had a discussion about one of our project in your seminar room over the last hour and a half. And we left a terrible mess in it, just like Americans tend to do. It's a very poignant reminder of the fact that it really is a privilege to engage in transnational conversation. So thank you for having me. Every day, hundreds of millions of people look at a screen that looks like this. I don't look at this screen very often, but the last time I did, there were pictures of me drinking too much at a professional conference in New York City. I think they're still there. Also, I'm from Silicon Valley, so in my part of the world, you're welcome to keep your laptops and iPhones, iPads open. You can check email. You don't even have to pretend to be paying attention to me anymore in Palo Alto. And you can also feel free to look up and make reference to things that I'm talking about, because for better or worse, it's become the new normal. And if I talk about phenomena that you're a little less familiar with, I'd prefer that you just go online and check them out rather than take my word for it. This platform and others like it changes the way all of us who study societies do our work. If we are humanistically inclined, we have to think in new ways about what it means to have an identity, what it means to have or be a friend, what it means to like something, and what it means to participate in a community. If we're a quantitatively oriented scholar, we have to think in whole new ways about what it means to measure a subjectivity, measure relationships among individuals, and indeed what it means to count an individual as a unit of analysis. Every day, millions of people go on a website that looks like this. Mere millions of people, but this entity has only been around for 16 months. In fact, if anybody does have a computer, I'd be eager to have you go online and check out something that I wasn't able to do earlier today. Who in the room has, this is the only time I'll ask you to raise your hand, I promise. I hate it when people do that. But how many of you know something about Coursera? Have heard of something called Coursera? Great. Coursera is a for-profit firm. It's headquartered in Mountain View, California, just down the road from Stanford. It was founded by two Stanford computer scientists, Daphne Koller and Andrew Ng. Daphne and Andrew, around 2008, 2009, along with a handful of other computer scientists at Stanford, started messing around with their own classes. They thought, why do we teach 500, 600, 700 students in darkened auditoriums twice a week? That's a foolish way to spend everybody's time. Why don't we make digital captures, just like is being made of me, I believe, make digital captures of our lectures and convey them to students as homework, and then when they come back into class, we can talk about the material. That worked pretty well. So then Daphne and Andrew and one of my bosses, John Mitchell, Jennifer Wydom, who's the current chair of the computer science department at Stanford, started doing some other things. They were like, why don't I embed some questions in the screen capture of the lectures to make them more interactive? So we kind of break up the content. And students like that, and they thought, well, why don't I put the assignments and maybe even the exams online? And why not have as much of them as possible be machine graded instead of hiring TAs to do it? And then now that my students are engaging in discussions online, maybe we can do some data mining on the hundreds, thousands of lines of text that are being produced on the courses. And by 2011, Daphne and Andrew and several others realized that once instructional interaction happens through a screen, teaching and learning can be data sciences, and therefore amenable to the analyses of computer science, and perhaps amenable to computer science engineering. And Stanford being Stanford, these faculty were spending a lot of time with some of their friends in private capital, one of whom is married to Daphne Koller, they collectively came to see that everyone on the planet with a broadband internet connection was potentially a customer for an educational service. And in 2012, Daphne and Andrew took leaves of absence from Stanford and created Coursera. And the business model of Coursera has not yet been determined, but the technology, the service is very clear. Universities like Stanford, and I'm curious if anyone is able to go online, I didn't have the time to see which German universities were members of Coursera, so if anyone can find that out, that'd be great. Over 100 universities worldwide signed contracts with Coursera to produce online versions of, say, Stanford courses, and they're delivered free to the world in a form that in a phenomenon that is referred to as a massively open online course or a MOOC. This turned my world upside down because I am a political economist and I study universities. It would have been completely foolish for me to not drop everything I was doing and pay attention to this phenomenon, which is what I want to talk to you about today. And I want to suggest to you that just like Facebook is transforming fundamental aspects of social, like Facebook and things like it are transforming fundamental aspects of social life generally, Coursera and things like it are changing fundamental aspects of higher education. And they will, in fact, they will oblige us, and all of us who are students of knowledge production and higher education, to think in fundamentally different ways about how we understand the educational process. What it means to be a student, what it means to have a course, what it means to be a university, and what it means to educate are essentially in a moment of great turbulence at present. And the other, I moved from New York City, the capital of cynicism, to Silicon Valley, which is the capital of optimism. Both places speak in hyperbole. So I may err in the direction of grand claims making. So I'm warning you about that now. But it's also the case that I feel a deep sense of urgency about this moment in history, and I want to take every opportunity I can to impress on my colleagues in the social sciences worldwide just how large the stakes of this organizational and thereby intellectual transformation are going to be. Right? What am I going to do today? I'm going to push the buttons in the right direction. Any German universities? Anybody find some on Coursera?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. The third party in the room is always technology, right? I want to offer you the briefest possible history of the relationship between states, schools, education, research, and citizenship in the 20th century. Swallow hard, Mitchell. You're in Germany, but you're going to do it anyway. I'm going to do it in 5 minutes, too. Watch it. I'm going to offer you a description of how digitally mediated instruction disrupts those relationships, the relationships between state, government, and citizenship that we have long theorized, in fact, presumed. I want to suggest the implications of this disruption for education science, business, national government, citizenship, and the self. And I want to suggest at the end of the after this evening that we may well be at a new moment in the history of modernity. What do I mean by digitally mediated instruction? And I want to distinguish digitally mediated from digitally supported, okay? Digitally supported instruction is, bring your laptops to class, we're gonna do some exercises, right? Digitally mediated instruction is, you can't have the instruction independently of the computational capacity, right? The relationship doesn't happen without the computer or the machine. There may be other aspects to the relationship, but you can't really have the relationship without that. And that'll become, why that's important becomes clear in a moment. We've had digitally enhanced instruction for a long time. In fact, it's very fashionable in the United States. The iPad is an elementary school teacher's, you know, most glamorous accessory. But this is a different thing than digitally supported. Let me give you a brief sense of who I am and intellectually where this comes from what its roots are in my own thinking, and Simone very deftly summarized that. In the early 2000s, I was doing field work in a selective college admissions office in the United States, and I was interested there actually in carrying out the work that Wendy and I had done on quantification. I was looking for a place where quantification of unlike objects happened routinely. So cases in which, as a workaday problem, people compared apples, oranges, and bananas, and integrated them into a single unified decision. So Wendy had used cost-benefit analysis to do this, and I thought selective college admissions in the U.S. would be a good place to do this, because in the U.S., a wide plurality of factors are brought into comparative and legitimate assessment. Your academic standing in your school, your scores on standardized tests, your grades, your ability to play lacrosse or water polo, your zip code, whether or not your parents went to the institution. All of these things are legitimate considerations in the United States. And I was interested in sort of watching how that process of decision making happened. And in the process of doing that, I realized that the reason that the evaluative enterprise in the US in higher education was so plural was because colleges and universities fed themselves in very plural ways in the United States. So rather than having a single patron, as is the case in Germany, for example, U.S. colleges and universities seek resources across a wide plurality of players, some from state and federal governments, but very often from the pocketbooks of young men and women and their families. Also in the form of large donations, also through contracts for media contracts for intercollegiate athletics. So turns out that, you know, football and who your parents are and what your zip code is really do matter to the resource streams of U.S. higher education, and that there was a direct relationship between how the quantifications of admissions evaluation worked and how U.S. colleges and universities fed themselves. In order to figure that out, I needed a much more sophisticated political economy of higher education in the United States than was currently available. And I set out on a collective journey across the social sciences with a handful of colleagues, well, actually a great many colleagues, to think through, you know, what would an organizationally sophisticated social science of higher education look like. And we wrote this article, Civ Incubator Temple Hub, which we used four metaphors to describe the different ways in which higher education had been apprised in North American sociology. Civ is the stratification tradition. Call it higher education sorts and stratifies. That's like breathing in American sociology, right? This is the default explanation of what higher education does. It stratifies. Incubator is the socialization tradition, so the idea that, you know, selves change as they move through the time and space of school. Temple is the tradition of John Meyer and his colleagues out of Stanford, which it's a sort of marriage of in interesting ways of Weber and Foucault, of that universities are the temples of secular modernity, essentially. They're where secular moderns worship the ideal of knowledge as a vehicle of progress. And they're repositories or reliquaries for where we put the most esteemed knowledge. And Hub was a metaphor for an emerging network network social science of universities. So, you know, what would a network model of Stanford University look like, or a network model of the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies, right? Where does it sit relative to the other systems of knowledge production and, dare I say, of government in the German state? So we did that, I had the great pleasure of joining a project of Cynthia and Setanay's that we're currently calling Thinking the World. We're writing this book for Princeton. And that's a study about how US universities organize research on the rest of the world. So if you think about the rest of the world as a kind of management problem for provosts and rectors, right, what are we going to do with Latin America? Where does it go? Does it go into the disciplinary structure of the department core of the university? Do I carve up Latin America into its land masses and economics and political science and anthropology and put those different pieces in different parts of the university? Answer, yes. Do I create a special program or project on Latin America to focus research geographically as well as intellectually? Answer, yes. Do I respond to the wishes of a wealthy donor, perhaps a Brazilian beer magnate, right, who is very interested in having Stanford support research on education policy in Latin America? Answer, yes. Right? And so you get a very complex accretion of organizational forms through which the study of a particular part of the world is organized. And the master narrative for how the world got carved up in the United States during the Cold War was an area studies model that was championed by the Social Science Research Council, among others, and carved up the world in ways that were pertinent to the geopolitical project of the United States in the Cold War. Well, the Cold War ended, and fundamental changes in the character of cultural study in the United States and worldwide sort of delegitimated the idea of regions as coherent objects. So the regional model kind of has eroded in the US, but has never been replaced by a similarly coherent administrative logic. Right? And that's the work that Cynthia and Setanay led, and that I had the pleasure of joining. And last year we were going to finish this manuscript, and then several things happened. Among them is that Daphne and Andrew started Coursera. Stanford responded by creating a whole new unit of itself, the Vice Provost of Online Learning, which is about the largest thing that Stanford could do. It now has a Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, a Vice Provost of Graduate Education, and Online Learning. So at almost exactly the same time, Harvard and MIT create an entity called edX, which is a not-for-profit organization to which each of those institutions committed $30 million. And this has upended the national conversation in the United States about higher education. It's akin, I have argued many times, to how these same institutions in the United States responded to the civil rights and black power movements in the 1970s, in which the elite schools recognize what has been a long-term shift in the larger context within which they work, and rather than waiting for the federal government or for that matter, an industry to make the rules for the universities, the universities are trying find ways to make the rules for themselves. In the 1970s, the response to the civil rights and black power movement was the diversity ideology in US higher education. So I think we're at a moment, but what the official response by places like Stanford and Harvard is to online is still being written, but that I think is the sort of scale of what's going on. So this was all happening in the computer science department. I'm pretty sure that, you know, no one got on the red phone and said, gosh, what does the School of Education think? We can't, you know, the engineers and the provosts can't do a thing without the A few of us in the Graduate School of Education, which is where my primary appointment is, sort of raised our hand and volunteered. And in revolutionary moments, you get opportunities that you might not otherwise get. But I hope this will give you some sense of the what I'm talking about today. I think inherits a couple of different strands of thinking that will should be familiar to you, whether you're students of quantification or formal organization or education. Okay. All right. Here's the briefest possible history of the relationship between education, state, and students under modernity. And please feel free to interrupt or ask questions whenever you like. I was trained in the German tradition, the American version of the German tradition, so I think of myself as a Bavarian. But if you prefer your modernity in French, you're welcome to think about Michel Foucault. There is great scholarly consensus in what I'm talking about, so there are echoes in what I'm talking of my remarks, or there are precedents for my remarks in the work of the great American sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois out in California. We read the hybrid of Foucault and Weber in the form of John Meyer and Chiqui Ramirez and his many students. Or if you'd like the Marxist feminist version, you can think about Heidi Hartman. But what I'm telling you is certainly I'm just standing on the shoulders of giants here. Okay. So one might argue that I would argue, following these ladies and gentlemen, that the constitutive organizational expression of modernity is the state. The rise, and shall we say triumph, of the state is the kind of organizational sine qua non of modernity. Right? Imagining a state and then building out a state to serve the citizens that the imaginary professes is essentially the fundamental organizational accomplishment of modernity. One indication of the prominence of the state is the extent to which the category of citizen superordinates virtually all other categories. Okay, it superordinates the traditional relationship relationships of patriarchy. Get back to that in a second. It superordinates virtually all employment relations, and it superordinates religious relationships as well. Most of those other identities don't go away, right? But they become, in a sense, secondary to the essential category, which is the imagined relationship between a free individual and her state, her or his state. States co-evolve with citizens, but of course, citizens don't emerge fully formed from the womb. They have to be manufactured, which is the job of schools. Where do education researchers fit in? As a sort of interstitial consultancy, a parasitic consultancy to state and schools, right? Virtually all of the virtually all of the educational research in your society and mine, and virtually all of the quantitative research in your society and mine about schools is done with data that are produced by government agencies or are funded by government agencies. That's how education research works. Censuses, education ministries of various sorts underwrite the production of data systems that some of us get paid to crunch on behalf of governments and schools. And sometimes they read our papers or invite us to their conferences. And policy decisions are informed by what we do. The official story about what educational researchers are doing is always that they are informed consultants of schools and states. So education research as an enterprise is essentially part of this apparatus of citizen production, if not parasitic on it. Higher education is an interesting mixed case, even, well, it, not mixed, it's an interesting case, even,
and this is even more so in my country than in yours, in that it has a pluralist governance structure. Okay, so in the Northern European tradition, universities are very much part of this apparatus of citizen production. And you can just follow the money, right? You know, where universities get their funds determines the extent to which they cleanly fit into this citizen production apparatus. In my country, federal and state governments have long played a role in higher education, but only a partial role. So universities themselves are what I call quasi-sovereigns in the United States. They exist in a state of semi-independence from government. That is true in most of the world, but to different degrees. So let's watch this thing float, and you can think about this very easily imagine a cross-national comparison here. In fact, Justin and his colleague David Baker at Penn State University are apparently up to do something just like that. All right. What happens next in my slides? I can't remember what the next slide is. Let's see what happens. Why don't we do it this way? Now, this is of course not the only depiction. This is not modernity all by itself, that's for sure, they say, right? But another very large, you know, category of the engine is this huge pool of power that we'll call private capital. And one of the signal accomplishments of state formation in the enterprise called modernity is that an elaborate state bureaucracy in a political process accretes to mediate the relationship between private capital and government, right? Bill Gates, who, for the record, pays some of my bills, right, indirectly, can't just walk up to Congress and get whatever he wants, right? Bill Gates has to use the machinery of government in order to get the kind of organizational change that he and his wife, Melinda, might want in higher education. Now, Bill and Melinda get, note how I'm using their first names. This is how it works in the United States, right? Bill and Melinda can walk up to the doors of many houses in Washington, including the White House, but they can't just by administrative fiat get what they want. They have to work through the apparatus of government, and they're being very successful at this moment in history in getting the state bureaucracy to respond to their desires for the future of higher education. In the United States, in addition to the accretion of a state bureaucracy, we created a very rich philanthropic tradition, which was another important way in which private capital was sort of buffered from complete power over government. Bill and Melinda can't get anything they want out of Congress by fiat, and they can't really improve higher education all by themselves. They work through their own quasi-government called the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has a beautiful suite, a beautiful campus of offices on Lake Washington in Seattle. Right? And this is a storied American tradition that largely built higher education, or Carnegie, Ford, Mellon, industrial era fortunes that really shaped a great deal of American politics. And so, you know, this was the project of the 20th century, was developing an organizational fabric that buffered private capital's influence on the machinery of the state apparatus. What happens next? Well, now I want to suggest, and here's the Silicon Valley hyperbole, now I want to suggest we're at a moment of remarkable organizational innovation in which new providers are promising your citizens and mine that higher education can be delivered and consumed independently of the government apparatus of citizen formation. In this world that did not start in 2011, I mean, it's been under construction for a generation, but Coursera, I would suggest, has, and the current moment has crystallized this process. There we go. the citizen, the student citizen becomes a student consumer and has a direct, has a lot of her production is underwritten by the state, but at least some of it happens through these third parties that exist independent of the apparatus of government, like Google, like Facebook. Coursera can do its work whether or not the German state thinks it's a good idea.
Right?
If the German state decides that Coursera is not a good idea, Coursera can go to Qatar, Pakistan, Mexico, Uruguay, Luxembourg, Canada. If the state of California, where I work, decides not to grant legitimacy to Coursera, Coursera can go to Michigan, Florida, Canada, Luxembourg, Russia. You get the idea. Like Facebook, like Google, it exists independently and can act as it has it can act largely independently of government if it wishes. An emerging, I think, urgent question is what kind of organizational skin will develop to moderate the relationship between new providers, new, I forgot to remind you, for-profit educational providers and the educational production apparatus that we inherit from 20th century modernity. But of course, it's not just Coursera. It's also Facebook and LinkedIn and Google and iVersity, which you may have heard of on this side of the continent, the Coursera of the EU, I'm told it is. And perhaps any of the other scores of vendors that I met at the online Educa Berlin conference, currently in its 19th year. That was last week. Now, why is this going so fast? I'm going to speak for about 10 more minutes. I'll have plenty of time to talk. Okay? Why is this going so fast in the United States? And it is going really fast. I live in a world in which I wake up every morning and think, what will be in my inbox today? I'll give you an example of that in a second. Why is this going so fast in the United States? It's going very quickly because the US state and federal governments are only partial patrons in higher ed. That's terrible. Only partial patrons. I didn't mean to say it twice. In higher education, they always have been partial patrons. So there's been a very large entrepreneurial private sector in the United States. We are a nation of school builders. Part of it has to do with our long tradition of religious pluralism in the United States. So the various strands of Protestantism and Catholicism needed, essentially competed for intellectual primacy and the training of their own clergy. Higher education, school building was also part of the project of westward expansion in the United States. So one of the ways in which you sort of signal to Eastern capital, right, to a skeptical Eastern establishment, that you were a real place, right? That Ann Arbor, Michigan was a real place, right? And San Francisco was a real place, was by investing in cultural institutions that would catch the attention of a sophisticated Easterner. So sort of simultaneously a religious project and an economic development project, if you will, a marketing strategy. But the secular trend in the United States for public funding has been a long-term decline in infrastructure building. We still spend a great deal of money on funded research and a great deal of money on subsidized student loans. In the United States, the federal government lends you money to take into a market with which you make decisions about which college you will purchase. Essentially, it produced a market. But we're still putting money in the pockets of students, and we're still investing a lot in science. But we haven't grown post-secondary capacity in the United States in a generation. So the number of seats in public colleges and universities in the U.S. is about this public colleges and universities in the U.S. is about the same as it was 25 years ago. At the same time, we're shoving more and we're asking more and more people to enter college and university in the U.S. It's not working very well. We have our college completion rates in the United States hover at around 50%.
It's not a pretty picture. So it's costing more, it's costing you more, and you're getting less. That's been going on for 20 years. Definitely there's a strong pro-business culture at this moment in U.S. history in particular, but we've always had a pro-business culture in the U.S. That's part of what makes us, not Europe, right? And a Republican Congress. We have activist philanthropies, like my patron, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, intent on changing the business model of higher education. So the Gates Foundation is in year six of a 20-year commitment, they say, to improve the efficiency and productivity of higher education, bending the cost curve in higher education. And it's not just the Gates Foundation, it's also the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation from Hewlett-Packard. Just as the industrial era fortunes of the 20th century, Carnegie, Mellon, Ford, Sloan, architected the higher education of the 20th century, the new high-tech fortunes of this moment are now becoming conscientious enough to try to embed their vision of a productive society on all of American schooling, K-12 schooling and higher education. And they're very, and just like in that prior era of applying sort of industrial production logics to higher education, expansion, mass production, standardization of delivery, the new fortunes are etching their logic, efficiency, flexibility, bias toward action, freemium models, right? New organizational technologies that are seeking to apply them to higher education. And what really did happen in the last few years is that teaching and learning became data sciences. So, like I said at the beginning, a small number of engineers, many at Stanford, many at MIT, basically realized that what Google did for search in the 1990s could be done for teaching and learning if teaching and learning happened through digital mediation. So basically overnight, teaching and learning went from being low status problems in the United States to very high status problems because they basically became computer science and engineering. So there's a personnel and an attention shift underway at the very highest levels of the American higher education system. And the reverberating effects are only beginning. So that's why it's going so fast in the US. Why is it urgent everywhere? This is one of those things that showed up in my inbox about 6 weeks ago, in a couple hours in advance of the press release. LinkedIn, you've heard of LinkedIn? Oh yeah, you've heard of LinkedIn. Well, LinkedIn and Coursera just recently signed an agreement in which at the push of a button, you can have all of your Coursera course certifications listed on your LinkedIn page. Push of a button. I completed these courses in Coursera. They're part of my portfolio. And Coursera's only, like I said, only been in existence for a year and a half. And the other kinds of mergers that we can only imagine. What happens if Facebook buys Coursera? Or if Facebook and LinkedIn join forces, create other button push connections? The way in which educational production and certification are going to be reorganized in the new knowledge and credential economy of the web is something that that the president of Stanford University has only recently begun to consider. Implications. Huge opportunity for science. Huge opportunity for science. I've got some great pictures I can show you later if you like. Digitally mediated instruction creates ongoing, hitherto unimaginably rich waterfalls of information. The educational process that we can only infer by our wooden year-to-year completion models, right, or degree attainment accrual models, can now be replaced by extraordinarily granular descriptions of how particular students move through the time and space of school. We don't even have to believe the lie that regression analysis obliged us to swallow for the entire 20th century, which is that Simone and I move through the time and space of school independently. Right? In order for the math to work, Simone and I, even if we sat next to each other in class year after year, had to be statistically independent of each other in order for the math to work, right? Goodbye, right? That lie is does not the data of digitally mediated instruction and the computational capacity that is now available to us to granularly describe the relational way in which Simone and I might or might not move through the time and space of school. Enables us to think in whole new ways about how educational trajectories go. This raises from the country that brought you the NSA, all right? This raises very large questions about data standards, sharing, and governance. I'll fly home just in time for a meeting that is co-hosted by Stanford and the White House in Palo Alto, the second of three meetings, the first at MIT, the third in Washington, in which hopefully most of the 200 people in the United States who understand what's going on will be at one of those meetings, and we'll start to talk very quickly about, very concretely, about how we imagine standards for data sharing and governance in this world. You know, what will an open data science look like? Right? Will we get a data science of teaching and learning that looks like the data science of search, in which Google is unquestionably the center of the universe and we all feed at the periphery? Do we want an education data science like that? If the answer to that question is no, how do we create data sharing protocols? How do we create a world in which teaching and learning data can simultaneously be public and proprietary? What would that look like? Who will make the rules for that landscape? We can expect a full-scale reorganization of research careers almost overnight. The best data on teaching and learning are available through are primarily proprietarily housed. This has actually already happened for big data in the social sciences, which is why we have some of the best network scientists in the world working at Google and Facebook and Microsoft Research instead of at Harvard and MIT and Princeton and Mannheim, because the academic disciplines are not moving fast enough to house this science. So that's all under production. For business, huge opportunities worldwide, huge. Everyone on the planet with a broadband internet connection did become a customer, and the demand for higher education is only going to grow. I say at home, it's a great time to be in higher education, it's a lousy time to be on a tenure track. It's a great time for higher education. The demand for it's only going to get bigger. But it raises very large questions about who's going to make the rules, basically, and the character of higher education as a public good. This is why it's essential for me, for Stanford, for U.S. Higher educators, to be in constant conversation with Germany and Finland and Norway and Sweden. Denmark. Why? We can add to the list. Let's just stop there. Places in which higher education is still fundamentally framed as a public good. That is gone in my country. No one's sure if higher education is a public good. We kind of think so, because we pay a lot for it, and we respect it a lot, but we've structured higher education as a consumer service. And it's not quite clear what the business of higher education will look like. For government, all of the above. Plus, like I suggested earlier, the rapidity of data accretion and science in the private sector makes it impossible for any government to regulate and control on its own. This is already larger than any government will be able to control. So what that means for the the future of education production and governance is a big one. Digitally mediated instruction is fundamentally transnational, requiring whole new scientific and regulatory governance structures, which is part of the reason I'm trying to spend as much time in continental Europe as I can. And also, as where I began, very large implications for the character of citizenship and the self. The self may no longer be a national subject, right? The global citizen that we all, that many of us enjoyed saying, could not exist because citizens are products of government, may in fact be being brought into organizational reality, right? The self becomes not a servant or product or child of the state, but a portfolio of capacities, experiences, and credentials, a LinkedIn profile that changes as it needs to change. The self becomes more fluid and changeable than ever before, because if the credentials that I earned in the first half of my career no longer suffice for my move to Moldova, or my divorce from my husband, or the maturation of my children, or the midlife crisis that I had at one point along the way, I can retrain and recalibrate myself, right, to be this next person. There's a reason why yoga is so popular in the Bay Area. Right? Its metaphor of flexibility is a sort of physical parallel to the way in which the self is expected to develop this moment in history. This is all great. There's lots of opportunity. The promises for human freedom are spectacular, but it may also be harder for nations to engender fealty to their projects, because the self literally does not need the nation in the way that she needed the nation in 20th century modernity to give her the raw materials that she needed to become herself. Right? So I think this may speed up more longer-term processes. Gosh, that's probably enough to say. We're trying to go as fast as we can intellectually and scientifically at Stanford on this. So there's a bunch of resources that are available on the web if you'd like. Those are my remarks.